You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Show is being underwritten by Roofers Local 20 and International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local 124. Roofers Local 20 apprenticeship provides the highest quality of roof applicators in the region. Accredited by the United States Department of Labor Bureau of Apprenticeship Training, our program provides Local 20 contractors with a workforce second to none. Craftsmanship and quality is what we do, on time and within budget is how we do it. For more information on Roofers Apprenticeship, call 913-281-2527. And the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers supports the Heartland Labor Forum. We've been wiring Kansas City since 1905. If you're not finding your electrical contractor at IBEWLocal124.org, then you're not getting the best value for your money. And the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, the word neoliberalism gets tossed around, but do you really know where it comes from and what it means? On tonight's show, we talk to Sarisha Naidu, UMKC economics professor on neoliberalism. What she has to say may surprise you. Then, we'll find out how workers are controlling the means of production at the 816 Bike Collective, a nonprofit bike shop in Kansas City. In the news, Missouri minimum wage will go up on January 1st, and another well-known labor leader from KC dies. He's Norm Hudson. Our feature at the end of the show is Know Your Rights with Angie Williams. Now for the news.
All right, and now the news from our side on December 19th, 2019. Longtime leader of Kansas City Federation of Teachers, AFT Local 691, Norman Hudson, died in hospice on November 25th. He was 82. Norm became president of the Teachers Union in 1973 during turbulent times as it struggled to grow enough power to win better contracts for teachers and better education for kids. At that time, the state of Missouri did not recognize teachers' right to bargain, but under Norm's leadership, membership grew from 300 to 3,000 in the union. In 1974, after the district had introduced a very unpopular transfer policy, which ignored teacher seniority, the union struck. Of course, it was illegal to strike, and Norm and a number of other teachers, including State Representative Judy Morgan, went to jail. Norm was allowed out of jail to continue to negotiate. The strike lasted 6 weeks, and the union won a pay increase and most of its demands. Kansas City passed an increase in the sales tax to fund returning art and PE to the schools. That was one of the key demands, as the district had eliminated them in budget shortfalls. Most importantly, the union had gained respectability and real power. It was provoked again into a strike in 1977, which was bitter, but the union not only staved off being busted, but won many of its demands. Norm was an institution in Kansas City labor for almost two decades. He was beloved by his members, and he in turn loved Patsy Cline and John Wayne. A memorial service will be held for Norm next year on March 28th.
The Economic Policy Institute reports that minimum wages will go up in 22 states as of January 1st, 2020. The increases will lift pay for 6.8 million workers across the country who will earn an extra $8.2 billion over the course of 2020. The increases range from 10-cent inflation adjustment in Florida to $1.50 per hour raises in New Mexico and Washington. Affected workers who work year-round will see their annual pay go up between $150 and $1,700, depending on the size of the minimum wage increase in their state. In Missouri, the minimum wage will go from $8.60 to $9.45, an increase of 85 cents an hour. This is the result of Proposition B, which Missouri voters passed by a large margin last year. Under that initiative, minimum wage will go up an additional 85 cents each year until 2023, when it will hit $12 an hour. After that, it will rise with inflation unless, of course, the voters again vote an increase or, by some miracle, the legislature raises the wage. The Missouri increase means that 5.4% of workers will get a raise in the state. That's 153,600 people who will earn an additional $123 million next year, the average annual increase being about $800. Unfortunately for Kansas workers, that state hasn't raised its minimum wage and remains stuck at the federal level of $7.25 an hour. Even worse, tipped workers in Kansas only get $2.13 an hour, which is the federal tipped minimum wage that hasn't budged since the early 1990s. In Missouri, the tipped minimum wage is pegged at 50% of the regular minimum wage.
In an article in These Times, Michelle Shin says that despite the fact that labor unions are more popular than they've ever been in 15 years, fewer workers are organizing successfully. In fact, the numbers of workers in unions is at a record low. The gap between the public perception of unions and their actual membership illustrates just how difficult it has become for workers to organize. She cites a report by the Economic Policy Institute, or EPI, which found evidence that employers are increasingly brazen in seeking to obstruct workers' attempts to unionize. Records of the National Labor Relations Board, which oversees private sector labor rights and union elections, reveal that in more than 40% of the 3,260 union elections during 2016 and 2017, employers were charged with unfair labor practices aimed at undermining the electoral procedures and retaliating against pro-union workers. About 30% of the unfair labor practice charges analyzed by EPI involved allegations of threats, surveillance, or harassment of workers. Another 30% involved allegations of illegal discipline, with one in five elections marred by the charges of illegally firing workers for supporting the union. The anti-union actions occurred at a higher rate during the two-year period than during the early 2000s. This pattern of union busting could help explain why private sector unionization dwindled to just 6.4% in 2018. Ben Zipperer, co-author of the report, told In These Times that the study suggests the hostile atmosphere towards labor, or basically the employer aggression against workers trying to form unions, is the main obstacle. Unions, of course, have been fighting for labor reform for decades, but neither Republican nor Democratic Congresses or the presidents have delivered.
Eight unions are on strike since October 13th against ASARCO, the copper mining company with a number of mines located in Arizona and Texas. ASARCO, which was facing massive environmental liabilities in Texas, was purchased about a decade ago by Grupo México, one of the largest copper mining corporations in the world. Contract negotiations broke down over negotiation of a new contract covering 2,000 workers at five ASARCO mines. The unions on strike include Teamsters, USW, IBEW, IAM, UA, IUOE, and the Boilermakers. The workers rejected ASARCO's so-called last, best, and final offer and struck in protest against the company's serious violations of federal labor laws. Carla Schumann, Secretary Treasurer of Teamsters Local 104, said Grupo México is a rogue company that believes it can ignore U.S. labor laws, recklessly exploit the environment, and abuse U.S. workers and their communities like they do in Mexico. Our brave members are striking to demand that ASARCO respect U.S. labor laws and honor the contributions of its dedicated workers. According to the Teamsters, Grupo México is one of the most vicious anti-worker companies in the world. And we'll have more about this strike next month on the Heartland Labor Forum. That's the news from our side. The news tonight was read by Keith Washburn, Sean Saving, Tom Gepkin, and I'm Judy Ansel.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Keith Washburn, and my guest today is Professor Sarisha Naidu from UMKC. She's an economics professor, and today our topic is neoliberalism. So as I prepared for this, I found out that most people don't know what neoliberalism is. So it's kind of a fascinating term, I guess I'd say. Professor, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Keith.
Yeah. So where did we get this? What does neoliberalism mean?
So I think it's not surprising that a lot of people are confused about neoliberalism because it's used in so many different ways. It's an economic project, it's a political project, it's a cultural project, and then it, you know, the sort of the sum of all of it plays out in ways that sometimes seem contradictory. So just to very briefly talk about that, sort of as an intellectual project, it's a project that wants to spread market fundamentalism. That's the core of the intellectual economic project. And we're talking about an ideology that talks about selling off public goods, privatization, you know, sort of free trade, deregulation, the celebration of self-interest over social needs, and where consumption is the only applicable form of citizenship. So it upholds the notion that markets serve as a model for restructuring all social relations, not just the economy, but also the governing of all social life. But it also is a set of business-friendly policy measures, and that have been imposed and perpetuated not just in the U.S. but around the world. And some of it is, of course, consistent with the intellectual economic project. And these policy measures are privatization, deregulation, free trade, financial liberalization, diminished public expenditure, which includes reducing its expenditure on health, schooling, social safety net, all things that we recognize even in the U.S., and of course, flexible labor markets. So that's, you know, the business-friendly policy measures. And then it's also a cultural regime in which we, you know, it's sort of a sense of incorporating it even within our everyday lives. So we begin to think of each other and ourselves as individuals who need to acquire capital, who need to have a competitive advantage over everyone else, and that we, if we are in control of our own resources, then we're free to make decisions based on our interests. And if we get ahead, then it must be because we have made good decisions, we worked hard, and it doesn't take into account all of the structural factors that might hold some of us back, that might sort of give some of us a leg up over others. So all of that becomes flattened. We're expected to be victors who practice intelligence, who practice greater efficiency, and all the losers are the ones who've had everything, you know, advantages very similar, but just didn't make it in life, right?
Right. That's the hypothesis or the, I guess, assumption behind neoliberalism. In other words, people who have started way at the bottom, like even below the bottom, so to speak.
Right.
Like did not have a good education,
right.
Came from a poor family,
right.
You know, whatever their circumstances were. The thought here, if you're a neoliberalism person, is that they should be able to bootstrap. They have the same
Absolutely.
Opportunities as I've had.
Yes.
And they're just not performing.
They're just not performing, and they're just lazy or not interested enough or just are not leveraging themselves enough, right? I mean, they don't have the right business model.
You know, what you're saying here, which I think I don't want our listeners to forget, is business friendly for many of us because we've been raised in a capitalistic mm-hmm. environment here in the United States. The culture is capitalism.
Right.
That's the way I would describe it. So, you know, business friendly sounds like, oh, well, that's good.
Right. Right. Well, yes, except that there is also, you know, what might be business friendly and good for business may not be good for me as a worker. And it might not be, so what's good for business, which may be, you know, making education profitable, right? Like education typically tends to be under the nonprofit sector, even if it's not public education. Well, but if you were to make it profitable, or think about health, right? Health has gone from being something that, you know, health professionals had this greater calling to now one where the health industry is focused primarily on or largely on profit making, right? And at the same time, and, you know, that doesn't mean that all the health professionals are making the profit, right? So we have nurses who are very poorly paid and various, groups of nurses who are poorly paid. We have doctors who are some sections of, that profession who are overworked, tired, don't get enough rest, etc. But of course, there are others in the, you know, especially the managers and the companies, the insurance companies, the hospital, the large hospital chains that do make a lot of profit. We have the pharmaceutical companies that do make a lot of profit. So actually, when I was maybe in an undergrad, I was reading a newspaper article which talked about a pharmaceutical company CEO who was really unhappy that particular season people weren't falling sick enough, and so, you know, their profits looked a little kind of lean. And it struck me, right? Like, so our health, right? And this is what we mean, right? By business friendly, right? What might be, you know, you can restructure laws that are business friendly, but might not be friendly to us as workers, to us as citizens, to our families, to our communities. And I think part of the neoliberal model has been to for all of us to identify with business, right? So what is business friendly must be good for us. And partly that comes from the notion that, well, if businesses are doing well, the benefit of that doing well, which is profit, should pass on to us eventually. It may have been true at some times in recent history, but it's definitely not true anymore. We have a situation in the U.S., but around the world, where profits have been increasing tremendously, but real wages, which is wages after you account for the price level and inflation, has not been increasing very much. And in some economies around the world, they've been declining. In other places, including the U.S., we don't see the kind of job creation that we would like to see. And by that, what I mean by that is that even if jobs are being created, they're not stable jobs that offer you economic security.
I want to go back to the health, what you said about health. So the business of healthcare, maybe we could say, I don't know if this is accurate, but maybe we could say used to be about keeping care of people mm-hmm. as opposed to keeping care of profitability. Is that one of the things that we've seen over the years? In other words, as we continue in this culture to become more focused on the bottom line,
right.
which would be profits,
right.
you know, maybe we're not only are we not doing that great of a job of keeping care of patients, I don't know about that. I don't know what the measurement is on keeping care of patients, but most certainly the workers are all feeling the stress and the strain more than ever. I mean, they've actually, you know, we've just continued to mechanize it and make the job, so much by the numbers, and you got to do this and make sure that, you're keeping care of this many patients. And
right.
The metrics of it all are being measured like never before.
Absolutely.
It's not just about going in and making sure that a patient feels good and that we're taking good care of them.
Absolutely. So sort of another little anecdote. One of the doctors, the primary care physicians that I was seeing, I kind of wandered into one of their hallways that I probably shouldn't have wandered into. And they had a little chart of, what is the maximum time that a doctor should spend with their patient, which, again, we're so conditioned to think that that's okay, that, that is, because money speaks and hence time is money and hence doctors shouldn't spend much time. But as someone, when I go to the doctor, I ask a lot of questions and I want to know. And we find, I have a friend who works on health communication, and she tells me about how, doctors and nurses kind of really resist questions because for various reasons. So one could be this notion of the expert, right? So you shouldn't question the expert. But the other thing is they probably don't have time, right? I mean, they're being told that they have 10 minutes to spend with the patient. They have to diagnose, hopefully correctly. But then they also have to enter, engage in all of this bureaucratic paperwork. And there is no time to actually listen to patients' concerns. And that's a problem. And of course, we know with nurses that they tend to be very, very overworked. They're not as well paid, even though some of them do the job that doctors used to do at some point. And, that's a big problem because nurses do play a very important role in providing care.
Of course,
right?
They're the first line.
Absolutely. And the same with teachers and education, within the education profession as well, right? We are seeing a spate of K-12 teacher strikes. And that's because we don't seem to care about this very important task of caregiving that teachers provide, of caring for our children, of caring for the next generation of not just workers, but our neighbors, our firefighters, our doctors, or just our, just our friends and community. I mean, I don't want us to think only in terms of creating monetary value in the economy. I want us to be able to think about our community, right? And we don't seem to value teachers very much. They're paid very, very poorly. We don't have the kind of support that we need in order to run schools that shape the future generation. And this is especially true of low-income communities and communities where the predominant population is people of color. And that's a huge problem because we seem to think that charter schools or private schools would work better. And the funding for education, higher ed as well, but also particularly K-12 education has declined significantly. And I think that says something about priorities. It doesn't say anything about whether we have the money or not. It says something about priorities.
Well, I wanted to just talk generally about the workers. And you've mentioned several different workers, right? Firefighters, school teachers. We talked about the health profession and so forth. So let's get back to neoliberalism as, policymaking.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, would you say that it is labor friendly? Meaning, is it worker-friendly or is it not so worker-friendly?
Does me laughing sort of provide an answer? Well, it's business-friendly. And if business thinks that labor should not be unionized, then that is what the neoliberal project has been about. So neoliberalism has a particular history, and we can get into that if you want to. But in the U.S., the Reagan administration heralds the neoliberal regime in the U.S. And one of the things that Reagan does is try, one of the first things that he does is tries to quell a worker's strike.
Was it the air traffic controllers?
That is correct, right? And that sort of heralds neoliberalism in the U.S., right? And similarly with Thatcher, who quells a mining strike in the U.K., right? And until that time, workers did workers' wages were increasing in the U.S. If you look at real wages in the U.S., up until it sort of increases as productivity, which is, you know, the amount that workers produce on average, as it had been increasing in the 60s, 70s, we also saw that there was a corresponding increase in real wages, and that starts to diverge from about the late 1970s. And then, you know, it sort of, you know, corresponds with Reagan taking power and engaging in sort of neoliberal or putting in place neoliberal policies.
So I don't remember what year Reagan was actually in the office. Do you remember?
In the 80s. I don't remember the specific date.
And you're saying Margaret Thatcher then,
yes,
right?
Yes, also in the 80s.
Yeah. Okay. So that kind of ushers in the new liberalism? Is that what you're saying?
That ushers in the new liberalism in the U.S. The first new liberalism project was, of course, Chile. In about, I believe, 1973, there was a political coup that deposed and killed the democratically elected president, Allende. And instead, we got a military dictator, General Pinochet. And this was with the backing of the U.S., and particularly under the tutelage of the Chicago economists, who put in place or, you know, kind of advised economic policies in Chile. And you had a very brutal dictatorship, and at the same time, these neoliberal policies that cut down worker power or, you know, unions, that sort of tried to do away with civil liberties. There are a lot of horror stories about people disappearing under General Pinochet, and and sort of things have come to roost right now because Chile is seeing widespread protests. I believe starting October 18th, and it continues, there have been widespread protests against the economic condition in Chile. And so Chile is considered to be the first experiment, experiment in neoliberalism.
Dating back to 1973.
Yes.
And you know, again, if you just tuned in, we're talking about neoliberalism, which is a bit of an odd term, you know, very much not what we'd expect. It's ironic that it was named neoliberalism, but it is not something that most liberals would ascribe to. It is something that more likely conservative folks, maybe even our current president, would ascribe to neoliberalism as an economic policy or set of policies, you might say. So if you just tuned in, we are talking here on the Heartland Labor Forum with Professor Sarisha Naidu, who is a professor of economics over at UMKC. And we're just discussing kind of definitions because it's really hard to get your head around, you know, when we're using the term neoliberalism, that really this means the most free market policies. So the idea, correct me if I'm wrong, Professor, that the market will solve everything. Just mm-hmm. let market go. No mm-hmm. policies, no intervention. You know, and as you said earlier, it probably would be good not to have any unions if you're neoliberalistic, kind of a purveyor of that policy, I guess, because there's no reason for that because the market will just automatically set everything and, you know, workers will be all happy because they'll all be making a wage that's fair. That would be the thinking of neoliberalists, not necessarily what we are advocating today. Mm-hmm. So we just wanted to make sure people understand neoliberalism is not what you think.
And I kind of want to say something. Neoliberalism doesn't have the, you know, you started off saying that not many people understand neoliberalism very well. And I think partly neoliberalism is not sort of an end project. It's a process. And so we've definitely seen an erosion of worker power and the ability to have better wages, better living standards, stable jobs. That definitely has declined if one were to make a generalization, right? I mean, specific industries, you know, there's all these differences, but sort of as a general statement.
You know, here in the United States, generally, it has been felt, at least I would say through the year 2000, that, you know, capitalism is good because mm-hmm. after all, look what happened to the USSR, mm-hmm. you know, those sorts of things. However, you know, capitalism left completely unchecked mm-hmm. doesn't necessarily help the working man. And mm-hmm. I would call it the bulk of our
of our nation.
Right.
You know, it of course might help the elite, the people that are at the top that are drawing those huge, you know, packages as CEO or whatever. All right, well, that's about going to do it for us on this segment of the Heartland Labor Forum. My guest has been Professor Sarisha Naidu from UMKC, and I'm Keith Washburn.
Thank you, Keith.
Thank you.
More people commit suicide than are killed by soldiers, terrorists, and criminals combined. If you or someone you know is struggling with thoughts of suicide, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-8255. This is a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet. Hear from regional and national guests, find out about upcoming events, and learn how to keep yourself and your family well. Tune in each week from 6 to 7 on Monday evenings or listen anytime at kkfi.org/podcasts.
And welcome back to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Sean Saving. We spend a lot of time on this show talking about unions, but unions can only go so far at creating autonomy for the working class. For workers to truly control the means of production, they have to own it. Worker-owned co-ops and collectives, while common in Western Europe, are few and far between in the United States, and in particular the Kansas City area. But do you know that for the past decade, the 816 Bike Collective has been slowly and quietly building a worker-owned and operated bike shop in the heart of the city? What started as one person helping neighbors fix bikes in the front yard has turned into a full-blown shop helping hundreds of people each year acquire and maintain usable quality transportation. Operating out of a rehabilitated turn-of-the-century building at the corner of 31st and Cherry in Midtown, Kansas City, Missouri, the 816 Bike Collective has become a model for how working people can reclaim their agency and humanity while building community based on real relationships rather than simply commercial transactions. Joining me in the studio tonight are two of the collective's founding members and current board members, Sean Egan and Suzanne Hogan. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So, Sean, I'll start with you. What is the 816 Bike Collective? Are you a charity, a nonprofit?
I don't know. I mean,
shop?
You really summed it up well in the intro. I don't know if we have much more to say. we're basically a DIY shop space slash bike shop to an extent. You don't come in, drop your bike off, and have us fix it and come back later. We work with you. We'll help you learn how to work on your bike. But a major point of our work is to empower people through education and make sure that people come away with more knowledge and hopefully a better working bike than they walked in with.
Okay, so just anybody, you serve anybody who wants to come in with a bike?
Absolutely.
Or a piece of parts or something
like
that?
Yeah.
Okay. So, you're open... some limit hours. So what's a normal day at the shop like, Suzanne?
So we're open Thursdays from 3 to 6, Saturdays noon to 5, and partly that's because we're an all-volunteer-run organization. But in the spring and summer, it can get pretty busy. I mean, we get people dropping off donations during those times. We have commuters stopping in who need help with making a repair or who want to learn more just about their bike in general, about ways to maintain it. And then we have people who are also looking for an affordable means to get around. So maybe they've been thinking about getting a bike or have a bike and they want to get out on the road. And so we do have some bikes that are already built up that people can get at a sliding scale rate. We work with people.
So, okay. So you've got completely finished bikes. You can just come in.
Yeah.
Walk out.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. We have a few. We have volunteers working on bikes throughout the year so that we have a nice stock of things, but like I said, it's sliding scale, so the idea is that the person who can't afford, say, to put more in helps out when the person who can't afford anything, you know, so it evens out in that way.
And you're a nonprofit, you're an official nonprofit, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
Okay, so, and then so these folks can come in with a bike, now people also come in and get parts too. Some
sure.
degree, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, we definitely, there's a lot of people who know a little more about what they're after, and I mean, come in and just we'll spend 3 hours looking through Ben's four parts specifically, and you know, then they'll come up and we'll just work out a price with them depending on what they want. And also, I just wanted to point out to the effect of people coming in who need a bike and sliding scale at the same time, like if people are literally without any sort of means at all, like, we won't turn someone away. We'll work mm-hmm. with anybody who needs right. it, especially people who definitely need sure. it, who it might improve their bottom line situation.
And right. that, it's my favorite part to see when you're talking about parts or even bikes, because everything gets donated there because it wasn't useful for somebody else at some point. It was maybe someone's trash at some point mm-hmm. or maybe taking up part in their garage, or it was like a nuisance, or it's just not working for them anymore, and they bring it to us, and then you see it transform, you know, while people are working together, learning things, and then someone comes in needing a bike, and then all of a sudden it's their transportation and yeah. a way for them to get exercise and engage with their community a different way. So it really comes full circle in this way that can be really a really exciting project to be a
right.
part
it
of.
Right, it keeps these things from going into a landfill yeah. or being or totally. You know, probably if it's metal, it probably would get melted down somewhere if it gets picked up by, you know, a metal recycler.
Yeah, hopefully.
Like that. But you've also got new stuff too. Like, you know, tubes, right?
And yeah, maybe, we have tubes and cables, just stuff that like in order to actually like out. Get through and like build bikes up to have. At right. you know, you for sale in any kind of way,
like that, yeah.
we have to be able to like put new cables in, because cables you can reuse, but each time they get shorter.
But the thing yeah. about the cycling industry, I mean, they're always making more and more bicycles every year, especially, you know, either bike shops level, like higher end mm-hmm. type companies, and even department stores. So it's like they're always cranking out more and more. But then when things break, it's hard for people to see the value in fixing them. And we're trying to get people to get out of that mindset. It's like, right. no, you have a thing that could work if you just yeah. put a little bit of time into it. So we're trying to get people to not think of things as disposable in that way, but actually.
Right. And sometimes I think it's hard to find out who can repair those things.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, that's like one of the major impetus for starting the shop, was just a realization that there are so many bikes. There are more bikes than there are people, yeah. and they are still making them. And there was no outlet for that. And for there to be something, and for it to help people learn and empower them to take control of their own transportation yeah. is.
And so many people that need bikes.
Yeah.
And I'd like sure. to say it's interesting too, because I mean, Sean and I have both worked professionally in bike shops, you know, getting mm-hmm. paid to be mechanics. Right. So we get the need for small community, small just bike shops. But our model's different, because even working in those shops, you see people coming in who can't afford, you know, even the cheapest bike, or can't afford to repair something, and they really need that bike to be able to get to and from a place. So mm-hmm. we understand that bike shops, you know, and the more commercial sense, serve their place in communities too. But then there's still a need for a place for people who can't afford that, well, and still need a bike and still need a way to get around.
Safety too. You need yeah. a safe bike. You get the brakes have to work.
Yeah.
It'd be nice if you got a helmet, got good pedals,
mm-hmm.
you know. And you guys have helmets too. And
we have some helmets, yeah. yeah.
So, okay. I mean, so how did the collective sort of start? Like, what was the inspiration for bringing this about? Like,
definitely, like, I was part of the very beginning, and like I said, a lot of it for me was just sort of like, I mean, simultaneously wanting to get into like fixing my own bike, and sort of realizing in that journey that there were so many bikes out there, and there was so much to work with for me to learn, and it seemed obvious. And then a friend of mine and I were talking about it and starting to learn, and then Suzanne happened to mention that she had actually worked for a bike co-op before in Santa Fe, and all the time I'd known her, I didn't know that it was a bike co-op that she had worked for, because I didn't really know what that was,
yeah.
except that I wanted to fix bikes, and like Suzanne got on board, and Kirk got on board, and there's a few of us, and we found a hole in the wall, almost literally, in a building down the way that is not where we are anymore, and sort of worked out how to get it going. And once we had a place and put the word out that we were taking donations, I mean, it just hasn't stopped since 2008.
Great. That's great. Suzanne, did you have an idea for, since you'd worked at a co-op, like how to model this, or did you guys kind of just figure this out as you went along?
I think we had ideas, but each place and project is so unique. I think the place that I volunteered, it was also a volunteer run thing then. Now they do more advocacy stuff, but I mean, we had an idea that we wanted it to be a place where everybody feels welcome, and have it, you know, it's about bikes, but it's about more than bikes in a way too.
Right.
It's about letting people feel that feeling of empowerment and being an educational resource, being a community gathering place. So yes, it's about bikes, but it's also about community and engagement, and, you know, building a sense of something more than just, you know, like, oh,
retail
a place to get, place to get my my flat right. fix or whatever.
Yeah. So what's your structure? You know, how are you, you know, a lot of folks here, we have a lot of union folks, so they know how their unions are structured. There's different forms of those. How do you structure your organization?
So, well, go ahead.
I would say we're all volunteers, which I think is a really unique model. I mean, we're basically all volunteers in our spare time. Like, we are in school. We have jobs. We have lives, you know. Mm-hmm. And so this is something we do in our spare time, is basically running a nonprofit. You know, like it's like running a business in your small town.
Right, yeah, right.
But it works because we have volunteers who see the value in it, too. And we all put in as much time as we can. And it
You have a board.
Yeah, we have a board.
We're like
501c3, and you know, and then there's, you know, there's the board. The board has space for more. There's people who are members and volunteers. There's sort of like a hierarchy.
So if you were
a volunteer and you've come long enough to become a member and you were interested and have shown and met the hour requirements, I don't have them on hand,
right.
but. I mean, theoretically, could be a key-holding member who has access to the shop and can,
oh, okay.
you know, and that's kind of like, you know, we don't pay, but there are benefits to being part of it beyond the intrinsic benefits of helping the community with
right.
transportation, which should be a right.
Right.
And so we sort of help provide that. And, but, you know, structurally, on paper, we're as we should be, and then in person, you know, we're a little different.
Okay. And the you mentioned that everybody's a volunteer. There's sort mm-hmm. of no paid staff.
No.
Can you explain sort of why your approach is that way? That could you be open more if you had paid staff?
It's something that's been talked about, and it's not something that's out of the question for the future. But I think it's been interesting over the years as we've been, you know, doing this as all volunteers and unpaid staff to understand how it feels more like a shared project in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Than I think if one or a few people were paid. There might be a hierarchy in that, or it might be
right.
Like, I don't know, a disassociation or a feeling of like not my responsibility that we don't want. We want everyone to feel responsible and a part of it and equally
right.
Invested to be able to. It's kind of the same model for people who come in, like give what you can, you know, so everyone can
right.
get from it. So
there are bike advocacy groups in town as well, and there are local bike shops in town, and I feel like we'd fill a space that is neither of those, and I think it's fine.
Yeah, okay. I like it, actually. I think it makes it – it's kind of nice. It's like, yeah, we're open 2 days a week. That's all we can do.
Hopefully
right
we can be open more when we get more dedicated
volunteers.
Members. Yeah.
Okay. You are listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Sean Saving, and I'm speaking with Sean Egan and Suzanne Hogan from the 816 Bike Collective here in Kansas City. You mentioned earlier you guys have started in a small spot, and I'd said here now you're in a building at 31st and Cherry. How long have you been in this current location? And sort of tell us some about this building, because I mean this is kind of a big deal where you guys are right now.
Sure.
I mean, this is not bikes you're recycling.
Right.
Recycling a building.
Yeah. I mean, so we acquired this building through the county a number of years back and sort of been, you know, working on it as we can just to get it up to snuff. And as of, 2 years ago, we had our grand open house in September of 2018.
Yeah.
I guess a year ago, just a little over a year
yeah.
ago.
We were on the road.
Yeah.
I wanted to go
okay.
to that. We were on the road that
Yeah,
weekend.
And that was our grand open house in the building. And, I mean, you know, this building could have not made it had it gone a little further.
Yeah,
but now we're there.
How bad was it? You needed a roof and everything?
It was pretty bad. And we got, like, a union's roofer group to help with the roof. Like, I mean, parts and labor was really donated. I mean, much
wow.
as our model is.
Yeah, yeah. KKFI understands that. We get a lot of
sure.
help to keep this place running. That's crazy. So how long, you had the building for a while though. So how long did that take?
Eight years.
But,
so we were still open in our other location on Troost during that time. So it was a very strained but exciting time for our volunteers to be working on the building whenever people could, and then also keeping the project alive. So, but to be able to transition to like what I like to call our forever home,
our forever home,
right,
was really exciting because to see all that work kind of pay off, and then it's a really inviting space, I think, that has just made it. So this has been the most successful year we've ever had.
Ever.
As far as traffic. And I love that people are finding out about us, like, through friends and just walking by.
Walking down the street.
Which
it's
is
very
super
new.
Cool.
Yeah, it's a great, the visibility in that site is so much. Well, the other place didn't have any.
No, we were in an alley.
You didn't know about the collective. You didn't know it existed. And this site, you know, it's 31st and Cherry. Folks are familiar with 31st and Gillum, where the Altorion ballroom stands, just east of the KCPT tower.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a high traffic area, and there's right on the corner is the 816 Bike Collective.
And an area that's changing a lot, too. But it's cool. I like it, too, because it's right on a place where a lot of people naturally bike along anyway.
For sure.
It's one of the best ways to get up and down town. So we're getting just a lot of
there's
cyclists.
Some bike shops who wish they had your location.
Yeah.
Right now.
They should open one. Yeah.
Figure it out.
Yeah, I want to talk about that a little bit, that neighborhood, because the area you're in, 31st and Gillum, I mean, it's finally starting to come out of a long era of decline. I mean, I've lived in that neighborhood for 15 years and seen it actually kind of get worse, seeing more places close than it used to be open 15 years ago and here until recently. So there's a lot of new businesses opening up and these long abandoned storefronts, and I think as we're seeing throughout Midtown Kansas City, and as anybody who's lived in any city who's kind of trying to get itself back on its feet, that this starts to pose problems for longtime residents and smaller business owners as big money starts to they're snooping around and, they're looking for prime properties, and all of a sudden rents start to go up and property taxes start to go up. Are you concerned about that in your location at all? How that might affect your ability to stay there, or is that
in those terms. I mean, we're concerned about it as just a way that we're seeing our city change and, wanting to keep character and keep people who live in neighborhoods and who've been here, to be able to stay. We don't think that outside developers should be able to come in and, basically economically bully people out of their neighborhoods. But, I mean, maybe I'm getting a little,
as a non-for-profit and sort of during this whole property tax mess that recently happened.
Right.
We appealed, but also we were talking to them anyway because they needed to check out our space to make sure that we were working as a charitable organization using it that way.
We have exemption.
So we're exempt from that. So,
but
I was going to ask about that.
And since we own our building and we're exempt, of course we don't, and we intend to use it for that purpose as our forever home.
Owning the building seems to be the key to these sort of situations. If you don't own, you have no control of what the landlord decides they want to do. Oh, it's time to sell out,
for
cash
sure.
in, and then boom.
Which that gives us more power, I think, to actually do our mission and to get at that bigger question of, how do we feel about it or how are we going to do anything? It's well, we're going to be there and we're going to keep being a resource for the community and for people to be able to have a cheap, healthy way to get around the city. So, I mean, the ripple effects of that, I think, are huge.
Yeah. Do you have any plan? What's your plans? What are your plans for the future? Anything in the horizon you can talk about?
Volunteer retainership. We really want more people to be part of our organization, to come in and reap the rewards of feeling good about what you're doing, so that we could be open another day, another 2 days a week. If we could be open more than a cumulative 8 hours a week, that would be amazing. I mean, our plans are small. We have more work to do on the building. There's a lot to do. It's never ending.
Parts organizing,
small parts organizing. If somebody,
you have a big kids bike.
We just donated 40 bicycles to Victorious Life Church. They do a big toy bike drive, us and a bunch of organizations throughout the city get together, and we get so many kids bikes donated throughout the years and only so many kids coming into the shop, so it was a real opportunity for us to get volunteers to put some hours in and build up kids bikes, and we came up with 40.
It was great. Wow, we took them over there on Tuesday, and they're doing
I saw some of them the other day. Nice bikes.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Good shape bikes. Kids bikes don't tend to get worn out. They outgrow them. Well, real quickly, here's a little bit of time. So if some of our listeners want to learn more about what you guys are doing, or want to come down and volunteer, donate a bike, what should they, where are you, when are you open?
Well, we're open, as Suzanne mentioned in the beginning of our segment here, Thursdays from 3 to 6. We actually just came from there. Okay. And then Saturdays, noon to 5. Okay. And also, we're at 816bike.org. We have a Facebook. It's the 816bike, I'm pretty sure. Yep. And Instagram.
It's the best way.
And we're hoping to get our website up and running a little better here shortly. We've got somebody, a new volunteer, actually, on that.
Great.
And so, yeah, or just come by 31st and Cherry. Our entrance is on Cherry, not 31st.
And we only accept donations during those hours, please.
Okay. Great.
It's true.
Well, you know, Sean, Suzanne, I want to thank you for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks
a lot. Fantastic.
Thank you
very much. That was Sean Egan and Suzanne Hogan, founding members of the 816 Bike Collective. You are listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. Stay tuned for Know Your Rights with Angie Williams.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Good evening, Kansas City. This is Angie Williams with the Law Offices of Angela L. Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights. Since we are in the midst of holiday season right now, I thought I would talk a little bit tonight about something that's always an issue during this time of year, and that's alcohol use, both as it relates to personal holiday parties and getting a DUI, and as it relates to holiday parties at the workplace. So first, let's talk about DUIs. This is something no one likes to talk about. They are not fun, and they're extremely expensive, not to mention they're very dangerous. So in Missouri and Kansas, both states have something called an implied consent law, meaning that you have given consent by having a license and driving on the road to submit to a breathalyzer if a police officer asks you. That's why there are harsher punishments for people who refuse breathalyzers than there are in terms of licensing, than there are for people who submit to the breathalyzer and then possibly fail it. But in all DUI cases, there are two separate processes that happen at the same time. The first one is related to your driver's license. It's an administrative process. It is civil, so that means that they only have to show it's more likely than not that you were drinking and that you were over the legal limit in order to suspend your driver's license. These suspensions can last for several months to several years, depending on the number of other traffic violations that you've had. The second part, and this is the part that's more familiar, is the criminal part. In these cases, as in all criminal cases, the prosecutor has to show beyond a reasonable doubt that you were drinking and that you were driving with a blood alcohol content of higher than the legal limit, which in Missouri and Kansas is 0.08. Now, that's not very much. When a police officer stops you and you are suspected of being intoxicated while driving, you will be asked to do field sobriety test. If they feel that you haven't passed it, then you'll be arrested. Your car will be towed. It will be impounded. You'll spend at least a night, maybe longer, in jail. You'll have to bond yourself out. You'll have to get an attorney, and you'll have to do a lot of things in order to keep your driver's license or get your driver's license back. The long and short of it is you could take a cab or an Uber to practically anywhere in the city from practically any other place in the city, and it would be less costly and less time-consuming than dealing with a DUI. And that is just the actual DUI. God forbid you would hit someone and kill someone or seriously injure someone. That is a whole different ballgame. So during this time of holiday celebration, and particularly as we come up to New Year's, make sure you plan ahead and have a sober driver or have a way home from all of these holiday festivities so you don't end up having to spend the beginning of our new year dealing with a DUI or the fallout from that. The second thing I wanted to talk to you about real quick is holiday parties. Now, holiday parties present a unique situation where employees may have some liability related to their behavior and alcohol, and employers may have some liability related to the behavior of their employees. Many things go into the decision as to whether or not a holiday party is considered a work function and therefore would be covered under workers' compensation laws or would make the employer responsible for bad behavior of an intoxicated employee. But suffice it to say that those situations do arrive. Employers, particularly small business owners, can help protect themselves. This isn't 100%, but this is stuff that you can do to help protect yourselves, like making the party non-mandatory by having the availability of non-alcoholic drinks, by encouraging people to take cabs or Ubers home. All of these things can help limit the employer's liability if an employee gets intoxicated. For the employee, of course, getting intoxicated to the point where you act like an idiot at a holiday party can very for sure affect your job. It may, if you act in this manner and you end up, say, harassing someone, that can have consequences. Or if you act really poorly, a employer could even fire you for bad and inappropriate behavior at a holiday party by becoming too intoxicated. That's really all the time we have tonight, Kansas City. Not to be a downer in this holiday thing, but please drink responsibly. Please act responsibly at both holiday and personal parties, and be safe so you can come back and listen to us at the beginning of the new year. Thanks, Kansas City. This is Angie Williams again from the law offices of Angela L. Williams. Happy holidays, happy new years, and be safe.
This is the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. It's really short. It seems that Christmas just sort of expands to fill everything, and there's nothing else going on. But tonight at 8 p.m., you can watch the Democratic debate. It's on NBC, MSNBC, and Telemundo with Spanish interpretation. It'll also be broadcast on KCUR Radio. So that's one thing you can do. And then in January, actually late in January, the 19th, there's the 16th annual Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Bowling Celebration hosted by United Auto Workers Locals 249 and 31 Civil Rights Committees. And that's going to be from 9 p.m. to 1 a.m. on the Sunday before the Martin Luther King holiday. You can stay up late and bowl at AMF Pro Bowl, 505 East 18th Avenue in North Kansas City. And you can find our calendar and our upcoming shows and our archived shows on our webpage at heartlandlaborforum.org. Tune in next week. On our show, we're going to have a book and a movie. We're going to talk about a book called The Democracy Collaborative, The Making of a Democratic Economy. It's about alternatives to the system you heard about on the first part of tonight's show. And we're also going to have a discussion about the movie Harriet. So tune in. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Keith Washburn, and stay tuned for the Thursday night special. Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI. The conditions where you come from to struggle and fight for the common.